House Education Committee will now come to order. It's Wednesday, February 5th, and according to the clock on the wall, it's 8 o'clock. Today we are joined by Representative Seaton, Representative Drummond, myself, Representative Gaddis, Vice Chair Reinbold, and Representative Ledoux. Today is National Digital Learning Day. Digital Learning Day is a national awareness campaign designed to celebrate and innovative teachers and highlight instructional practices that strengthen teaching and personalized learning for all students. Our agenda today is House Bill 220, House Bill 245, and confirmation to the University of Alaska Board of Regents. It's my intent to hear both bills, and we'll see what the will of the committee is, and pass the confirmation out of committee. With that, we'll take a brief at ease. And we're back on the record. We'll start out with House Bill 245, School Funding, Required Local Contribution, by Representative Tammy Wilson. Please introduce yourself, and you may begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Representative Tammy Wilson, District 2. Thank you for the extra few seconds to run back upstairs to get the information I thought I had. House Bill 245 is an act repealing the required local contribution to school funding, making conforming changes and providing the date to that. This looks like a really long bill, but it's really a very simple bill. And I probably should have said that at this point. The state of Alaska has a duty under Article 6, Section 1 of the Constitution of the state of Alaska to establish and maintain a system of public schools open to all children of the state. The fiscal burden placed on local governments that must bear the burden is enormous and consuming. The state of Alaska provides only partial funding to organized boroughs, home rule cities in the unorganized borough, and first-class cities in unorganized boroughs to carry out the state's responsibility for education by deducting a local contribution of 2.6 mils from the level of state aid as stated in 14.17.410(g)(2). In the area of Alaska outside organized boroughs, home city, rural cities, and the unorganized boroughs, home rural cities, and first-class cities in the unorganized boroughs, the state carries out its duty for education through state educational service areas established under AS 1408031, which exempt them from the required local contribution. There are presently 19 state education service areas. There's also an inequity that our bill doesn't take care of, and that is impact aid, where some of these, even though they do not pay local contribution, impact aid is taken off of what the state constitution says that the state should be responsible for. So there are actually two issues, but ours is only talking about local contribution of the 2.6 mils. In 1963, Alaska State Legislature passed, and Governor Egan signed into law, the Mandatory Borough Act, dictating that certain regions of Alaska, those encompassing Ketchikan, Juneau, Sitka, Kodiak Island, Kenai Peninsula, Anchorage, and Matanuska, Susitna Valleys, and Fairbanks to form organized boroughs by January 1, 1964. And just to remind those, Fairbanks had a vote, and they voted against a borough, but this is the act that made them a borough. Furthermore, Section 1 of the Mandatory Borough Act promised that no area incorporated as an organized borough shall be deprived of state services, revenues, or assistance, or be otherwise penalized because of incorporation. And basically, if you want to have parks, if you want to have fire service, if you want to have more police, that's what the borough was supposed to, or cities to pay for. It was never the intent that we would end up having to pay for things that the state would have paid for instead. So HB 245 removes the required local contribution penalty imposed by the state of Alaska on organized areas and again fulfills its constitutional responsibility. And with your indulgence, Madam Chair, I just want to give just a brief history of how this came about, because you may think that this has always been that way, but it hasn't been. So in the first foundation formula, basic need, which is a formula, a different formula, not specifically the one, they took off half of federal impact aid and then took off 3.5 mils for the state allocation to each district. In 1969, North Slope oil leases were signed. So you can imagine that windfall surpluses begin flowing into the state. Pressure builds from organized cities and boroughs for greater state assistance, and the legislature again begins debate on amending the foundation formula. And the second foundation formula, state support starts out at 90% of basic need, and throughout the 70s slowly increases to 100%. So this is when the state did take their responsibility on, and they paid both portions of this. Oil price crashes. Local contribution is again debated. In 1986, oil prices crashed to $9 a barrel, and the state panics. And the state's very good when they panic to what? Take the responsibility and give it to our local municipalities. State needs as much money as possible, and a new formula for education funding is proposed. In 1988, local contribution is back and at 4 mils at that point. SB 182-2012, in order to put all organized districts back to an equal playing field, the required local contribution was reduced to 2.65 mils and is based on the full and true value of property. And making it equal is because some areas were giving much more to education than others were when we were talking about the 4 mils. So they try to make it better by making it 2.65. So what does this mean to you? And most of you pay local contribution, but you pay within your property taxes. Does that mean that rules would no longer give to education? No. Right now, we do mandate part of that 2.65. But many boroughs and cities give over that amount, and a lot of them don't go up to the cap at this point. So this would allow them to go up to the cap and also have money left over to go back to citizens who pay property taxes or possibly lower their sales tax depending upon how they do it. But it is my feeling, and looking at the Constitution, that the state should fulfill the basic needs formula. They made the formula. And to look at the boroughs and the cities who became organized and took on more responsibility to have to pay this. And if you look at your fiscal note, you'll see a $206 million fiscal note. That's the impact that we are having on our boroughs and cities. With that, Madam Chair, I have Dan Bockhurst on the line from Ketchikan, who has been very instrumental in this legislation, that has more information or questions.
Thank you. Do we have any questions before we move on? I'd like to represent. I'd like to recognize Representative Sadler's joined us.
Madam Chair.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. You said you were addressing only the property tax and not the impact aid. So does that mean that under this bill, the 50% would still be subtracted from the rural education attendance areas, and so they would be paying then in greater proportion local contribution, and yet the municipalities would have no requirement to have a local contribution?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, no, that is incorrect. The part that is correct is right now the impact aid would still be subtracted off. It's 100% that's subtracted right now for the rural education areas. That would be the same for all the municipalities. So Fairbanks has impact aid. That would continue to be taken off of what the state would give them. So it would not make it uneven. What would still be unequal is that some give more than others. And you should find in your packet, it's the Alaska Department of Education, the foundation, and it will show in column D all the eligible federal impact aid. And then in E, it has the percent. And as you'll see, some of them are under 100%. If this bill were to pass, they would all be 100%. So Fairbanks, although it shows on here that they give $26,940,000, they would not have all that returned to them because their impact aid, it would increase on how much would be taken off. And if you look down, I think there's only one, there's very few that don't receive federal impact aid, very few communities.
And Madam Chair, and Representative Wilson, the question of the additional funding is limited to 23%. So if we're subtracting the full amount of tax, a local property tax that does go to schools, and then you can contribute 23% above, now you would be limited to that 23% above. So that my understanding is almost all districts are doing something above, and now that 23% would not represent even the equivalent of the amount of tax. So there would be a reduction in the amount of money that every school district almost, that sit within a municipality, that the local residents could give to education. Is that correct?
Representative, to the chair, that is not my understanding. My understanding, the cap would still hold, and so they couldn't give the same amount they're doing because it would put them over the cap, but they would be able to give what they are over the required amount. All this would do would be basically backfilling that portion that the state, by constitution, should be doing.
Representative Seaton.
Yeah, Madam Chair, almost all districts are doing something above their required local contribution.
Correct.
Eating into that 23%. If the required local contribution, which is greater than the 23%, is taken away, and only the 23% is available, it means that the ability of local residents to contribute to their schools is reduced. Is that not correct?
Representative, through the chair, when I went through this with legal, I used Fairbanks as an example. And Fairbanks gives approximately $48 million to education. They are only required to give $26 million. The 48 isn't to the cap. They have approximately $13 million more that they could give to schools. If this were to pass, of that $26 million, which of course will decrease a little bit because their impact day they wouldn't get as much credit for, so let's say it's about $20 million, they would be able to give 13 of that 20 to go up to the cap amount. The additional $7 million that's left over, I would hope they would give it back to taxpayers, but they could do other things that the municipality needs. So they would still be able to go to the cap of it, and probably more would be able to afford it. Now, let's say it's Wrangell instead. Wrangell already goes up to the cap. There is nothing left to fill. That difference for them would go back to the taxpayers or to something that the borough wanted to do outside of the schools. So from my understanding, this would actually allow more funding to go into those schools who are not currently paying as much in as they could.
Representative Seaton.
Well, thank you. The Fairbanks example is a good one because I think what you said was the local people would lose the ability for $7 million, which is currently going into their schools. They could not do that because that would be over the cap. $26 million, $48 million gives them half of that they can do, but then they reach the cap.
Representative, through the chair, no, that's not correct. What it is right now is that what you're not counting in, what you're saying $7 million goes back, is now that $26 million is being paid by the state. So the state would be giving in the $26 that we're giving as Fairbanks. Because that's the local contribution that we are now giving as our 2.6 mils. So that's the first part, is that 2.6 mils would be fulfilled by the state, which is the $26 million if this were to pass. That $26 million is the amount of money that we're using now. They still get the $26 million. It's just by the state instead of the borough. And then when we're talking about the additional $13 million they would be able to put in schools, that is the $13 million out of that $26 that they would be able to give in addition to what they're giving now because the state has fulfilled their mandate. So, no, schools get more. The only schools that don't get more are schools that currently are paying up to the cap. But they don't lose money either because it would be the same amount. The community would get the savings. But for those communities, I think Anchorage is one that's not up to the cap at this point. Mat-Su isn't. I think there's only a couple that have actually gone up to the cap. They would all be able to – they don't. It would be a choice of the community, so it's not a mandate. It would be up to the community what they wanted to do. But it would give the districts more money without coming out of taxpayers because we're already giving it.
Okay, and I think that what I'd like to do is move on to Dan Bockhurst, who may have a different way of explaining, and we may get a little bit more out. No offense, Representative Wilson.
No offense, taken.
Mr. Bockhurst, are you online with us?
I am, Madam Chairman.
Great, and I'm sure you've heard some of the discussion, and sometimes just having a different person say it connects. So if you can introduce yourself for the record, and you may begin.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, my name is Dan Bockhorst. I am the manager of the Ketchikan Gateway Borough. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. First of all, I'd like to commend Representative Tammy Wilson for her understanding of the bill. She explained it to you very well, and she responded to the questions from Representative Seaton very well. I have submitted 10 pages of written testimony for the record through Representative Tammy Wilson with additional materials. So I plan to keep my remarks this morning brief. Every good law should have at least three characteristics. It should be fair, it should reflect sound public policy, and of course it must be constitutional. The law imposing the required local contribution fails on every one of those three points. For that reason, the Ketchikan Gateway Borough strongly supports House Bill 245 that repeals the required local contribution. I'd like to explain. First, the required local contribution is far from fair. It creates two very distinct classes of citizens in Alaska. Those in 34 municipal governments of the 163 municipal governments in Alaska who are required by state law to operate school districts, and those in the remainder of the state comprising 19 other school districts in Alaska. The required local contribution imposes a crushing fiscal burden on the 34 municipal governments, shifting to them approximately 20% of the state's constitutional duty to adequately fund schools in those municipal districts. At the same time, the state exempts from the required local contribution those other 19 districts. It's important to understand that there is simply no rational basis for the disparate treatment between the two classes established by the required local contribution. Some of the most economically distressed areas of Alaska are among the 34 municipalities that are subject to the required local contribution, while some of the more prosperous regions of Alaska are among the 19 districts that enjoy exemption from the required local contribution. As Representative Wilson indicated, the required local contribution also fails the fairness test in that it breaches a critical promise to the citizens of Alaska expressed in the 1963 Mandatory Borough Act that boroughs will not be deprived of state revenues or otherwise penalized because of incorporation. The second prong, the required local contribution, fails the sound public policy test. The required local contribution is a grinding public policy that punishes organized boroughs, the foundation of local government in Alaska. The framers of our Constitution intended that the state would create inducements for boroughs. In fact, the Alaska Supreme Court has held that our Constitution encourages the formation of boroughs. In reality, Jay Hammond, former state representative, former state senator, and former governor, offered a far different perspective when he wrote, attractive enough on paper, in practice, the organized borough concept had little appeal to most communities. After all, why should they tax themselves for services received from the state gratis? Governor Hammond clearly told it like it is. I'd like to offer just six facts demonstrating how difficult the circumstances have become. Today, we stand 55 years after statehood, and much more than half of Alaska remains outside organized boroughs despite our constitutional encouragement of the creation of boroughs. Very few Alaskans have freely chosen to incorporate. Consider that residents of organized boroughs today, 95% of those are residents who live in the eight mandatory boroughs. This fact alone makes it compelling to honor the 1963 promise that Representative Tammy Wilson spoke about, established in state law for equal and fair treatment of boroughs. House Bill 245 would do much to restore the luster to that promise. Today, 55 years after statehood, those who have freely chosen to form boroughs are outnumbered by those who have freely chosen not to be in a borough by more than 2-1. An example of how ineffective our policy of encouraging boroughs is was evident 7 years ago when voters in one region of Alaska, with resources described by the state attorney general's office as the envy of most organized boroughs, rejected incorporation by a margin of more than 9-1. Over 90% of the voters that voted on the question rejected borough formation. Also telling is that having written, sponsored, and successfully shepherded into law the 1963 Mandatory Borough Act, former Representative John Rader repudiated the Mandatory Borough Act years later. He regretted having played the fundamental role in getting that law into place. Today, state officials speak in terms of the, quote, misery of boroughs, unquote, rather than the vision of those who wrote our Constitution. To me, these circumstances are the canary in the coal mine, telling you that the required local contribution is terrible public policy that weighs heavily on students, taxpayers, and others in organized boroughs. The third prong, the required local contribution is unconstitutional. The Ketchikan Gateway Borough has engaged in extensive study and evaluation involving a number of attorneys over the last 6 years, and we've attempted amicable ways of addressing our concerns, which have not been successful. So after 6 years of effort, the Ketchikan Gateway Borough last month filed suit over the unconstitutional aspects of the required local contribution. The law setting out the required local contribution dedicates public funds to a particular purpose, thereby violating Article 9, Section 7 of our Constitution, the Anti-Dedication Clause. The required contribution also operates in a manner such that the dedicated funds are never subject to legislative appropriation, which violates Article 9, Section 13 of our Constitution. Further, the required local contribution law circumvents the governor's veto authority in Article 2, Section 15. In conclusion, again, the required local contribution is not fair, it's poor public policy, and it's clearly unconstitutional. On behalf of the Ketchikan Gateway Borough, I therefore urge the passage of House Bill 245. That concludes my comments. If there are questions, I'll be happy to try to address them.
Thank you, Mr. Bockhurst. Any questions? Representative Drummond was in the queue. I'm not sure if she was
I was just commenting if the thank you, Madam Chair. It looks like Anchorage is pretty close to the cap. If the cap is the distance between the total budgeted education funding and the supplemental funding capacity in column F. Anchorage has not been that close to the cap in the past, but I see it's pretty close now. And in addition, where's all this additional money going to come from the state? We're already in severe budget deficits, and you're talking about several hundred million dollars in additional funding to keep schools whole.
Representative Drummond, through the chair, that's for finance to keep going through and finding those. Because the state is going into deficit, why should the municipalities have to pick that up? And that's what we're doing. The other choice could be, as a policy, is to look at all the districts. There used to be, from my understanding, a head tax for education where everybody who had a check, it wasn't by per person, it came out of their check at the beginning of the month. You know, this is a constitutional issue first. It is that the state is responsible for setting, well, policymakers set the basic needs. The state should be filling that obligation. Again, if we're going to go by funding, let's continue to look at that. If we're going to be going into deficit and we know that it's going down, at some point are we going to look at increasing that and making that 4 mils, 5 mils, 6 mils, to where local areas who have organized areas are going to foot the entire bill? Because that has been the way that the state has acted in the past. When they run out of funds, they look at the municipalities. And one further thing on that, Madam Chair, I attended the Nanana Borough. They're looking into becoming a borough. And the first thing, one of the people who were doing the presentation said, you have to give 2.6 mils as a borough and take over your schools as far as buildings, maintenance, almost all that. So we're not talking about just the foundation that our municipalities have. It's that whole portion of it. The first thing that you heard coming out of people's mouths were, why would we want to give 2.6 mils for something at this point that the state is taking care of? So before we even get the discussion of becoming organized and maybe taking on other responsibilities so they have more police service, fire service, some of those health and safety portions of it, what we look at instead is, how much are we going to go in deficit as a municipality because the state decided we could pay instead of them? And that really is the issue at this point. Constitutional, what do you believe? Is it the responsibility of the state to fulfill this mandate, or is it only the responsibility of the state when they have funds?
Thank you. Representative Ledoux.
I'm just sort of curious as, I mean, I served in municipal government. I was the mayor of the Kodiak Island Borough, and we always talked about how unfair it was that the REAs didn't have to pay anything, and we talked about maybe there should be a mandatory borough for those folks. We never talked about, you know, maybe this whole thing was unconstitutional. As a borough official, I probably would be head over heels in love with this bill. I'm just not sure at the moment what the impact it would have on the state budget. But, you know, looking over, I read that whole thing that Mr. Hicks wrote. There's probably a decent chance that whether the state wants to do this or not, that this Ketchikan lawsuit may prevail, and we may have no choice but to do it.
Quickly, on the, through Chair Representative Ledoux, I want to make sure to point out that there is impact aid into a lot of these. So to say that the REAAs don't pay anything into it, they do. What's very interesting, if you look down, for instance, Kenai Peninsula, they don't pay any, you know, there's no federal impact aid coming in there. So the $22,690,000 required right now would come back to them and not having taken off. But again, you know, we're using different kinds of formulas, and there are other ways, too, that if you want to make it to where everybody in the state is given equally, you do have that option. I find it interesting, two things, you know, both, that's twice now we heard, well, how can the state afford it? You know, when the Constitution was made, it wasn't could the state afford it, and what is the state's responsibility? And I really, you know, want to stay back on the Constitution that if, because this bill is not about mandatory boroughs. I am not advocating that everybody become a borough. What I want to do is make it to where we take one of the major penalties away from becoming one so that when one looks at it, they're looking at the services that they can give additionally to their constituents versus starting in the hole from day one.
I'm just sort of
follow up, Representative Ledoux.
Curious, are there other states in which the state has a constitutional mandate to fund public education which have charged their boroughs or whatever, their counties, with paying a portion of it? Are there any similar suits going on in other areas right now?
Through Chair, Representative Ledoux, not that I'm aware of. In fact, we are one of the few, if not only, state that the state actually pays more than the local municipalities. Most of the counties, it is literally on the local level, and they pay a lot of it. Not all the states, but we're, you know, but most states, the local groups use their taxpayer money, and then the state supplements that portion of it, where ours is almost kind of in reverse. But as far as I know, there's no lawsuits like this. There's nobody who has it in their constitution in which another group feels is unfair. They may think taxing is unfair, but I think that's just a human thing.
Representative Peggy Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Has anyone really defined what basic education needs are? I mean, is that reading, writing, arithmetic? I mean, you know, is it possible that this would backfire when we'd find out that the state's responsibility is to do certain things, and the rest, if the schools want to add those things on, they can?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, you, the legislature, has determined what basic needs is. How you did that, I couldn't speak to. But the formula has been determined as basic needs. It's gone through some court cases as far as, are we funding schools adequately? Are we doing the oversight? And one of the most recent court cases said that, yes, we are adequately funding education. Our oversight was not so good, and we had a judgment on that portion of it. So just by having that statute on the formula, that's how we have determined basic need. Now it comes down to who's responsible for fulfilling it, and then you get into some federal law, and that's what Representative Seaton was referring to as far as how that cap was determined to make sure that we're equitable throughout the state.
Thank you. Representative Reinbold.
I just have a quick question. In regards to the Anchorage contribution, it says $97 million, I believe it is, for fiscal year 2015. When I looked at the comprehensive annual financial report from the Anchorage School District, it actually showed that we gave $248 million for local contribution to education. So I guess what I'm wondering, that's one question, is it just because that's just the required and they can give more than that? And maybe you're not the right person to ask, because I'm looking at your face right now. And then also I wanted to ask a question.
And if you could ask just one at a time so okay. We can kind of all stay together, please.
Okay. Senator Chair, Representative Reinbold, the $98 million you're talking about, that's the required contribution. The other amount, now that I'm looking at the same thing, most likely is what they can give to almost up to the cap. Mm-hmm. You'll see on Fairbanks it shows $26 million approximately. We give $48 million. So there is a difference between the amount that goes in and replaces state aid to total contribution by a municipality.
Okay. Representative Seaton.
Thank you. And your comment on building schools was also interesting. So is the idea that if this passes and the state will be required for building schools and there won't be the 70-30 bond or 60-40 local contribution with the boroughs owning the schools, that would be like the REAs, where the state is going to be responsible for building the schools as well?
Through the Chair, Representative Seaton, when I was talking about buildings, it was referring to the Nanana Borough. If they became a borough, they would then be responsible for all the schools, which currently come underneath the state. No, this bill would have no impact on the bonding. It would have no impact on the capital projects that come through or the maintenance portion of that. All this would do would take the state and have them pay in based on their formula. All the rest that is currently being done by the municipalities would continue to be done. This is just talking about the basic needs formula.
And
please go ahead.
One more. Representative Wilson was getting at one of the things that Representative Peggy Wilson was trying to get at this, that one of the questions that I've had is that we were found in a court case to be adequately funding education. There was nothing that said that if we had funded less or if we hadn't had our contributions for that we've added for career and technical education and those things, if we didn't have those components in there, that it still wouldn't be adequate. And I think that's what she was saying, is an adequate education and basic need could be reading, writing, math, those things could be considered an adequate education, in which case there wouldn't be a requirement for the state to backfill money. And so the question becomes is what happens when the schools are limited, like the Kenai Peninsula Borough has historically been funding at the cap. I have no confidence at all that the state is going to backfill $200 million in the future, all these future years, by saying that basic need includes all these pieces that we've added on to education to provide really good education and career and technical education, and all of those aren't required as far as basic educational need. So limiting the ability of the taxpayers of a borough, because they're limited to the 23% of the cap, and if the state doesn't backfill to what is considered basic need, because $200 million a year just to maintain where we are, I don't think we're going to do. So I guess my concern with this is a system that's coming up is going to reduce funding to the educational system, because I don't see us actually adding $200 million to backfill the taxes that are available, especially for those that have been, you know, really contributing to education funding to the cap. They're the ones that would see the greatest reduction, because if you haven't been filling to the cap, then you still have room in there to contribute.
Representative, through the chair, nobody gets less funding. If you're going to the cap, your community is going to get the same amount of money. The question is,
who's going to pitch in more. So no one through this bill gets less money. Okay, so I want to make sure that's clear. They may not get more money because they're already going to the cap, so there's not any additional funding. The legislature at any time can change the basic needs formula. If you don't think it works, you're more than welcome to change that. You know, but the legislature right now has this particular formula. They have determined, those who made the formula, that this is adequately funded. It has gone through at least one court case, could go through another one, and that could possibly be determined different. What the word adequate means, we hear that a lot of, what does that really mean? But at this point, all I can tell you is that there is a basic need formula that the state put together to determine what it takes to educate a child at a certain level. And then, of course, they've added to where voluntarily municipalities could get more up to a certain amount. Okay, so that's a fact. The other fact is that the Constitution says it's the responsibility of the state. Not the responsibility of the state when they have extra funding, not the responsibility of the state when they want to. It's the responsibility of the state because it was a promise to boroughs. Fairbanks, North Star Borough, they don't want to be a borough. And if you ask most of them right now, they don't want to be a borough, but they are. And so part of that was, we're going to make sure that you get these services. And the state at one point said, well, guess what, guys? We don't have enough money. And so we're going to point to you because you're the easiest mark to fill that portion that we don't want to. And what is interesting to me is, as we've had extra revenue in oil, nobody bothered to go back and say, look at the detriment, because if I'm paying all this in property taxes in Fairbanks, it's not going to my economy. And now with the news yesterday that Flint Hills is closing, another hit to our community, we're still going to have to pay this. And we want to help our schools. And I think it's very exciting that without extra taxpayer money, if this goes through, our communities who aren't up to the cap actually gain from this, while the state fulfills what is their responsibility, not just when they have funding. I mean, to me, it's pretty cut and dry that Mandatory Borough Act was put in, and that was supposed to be fulfilled by the state. They determined they didn't have enough money. They were going to push it off on someone else, and we've allowed it to happen all these years.
Representative Ledoux.
I know one bill can't fix everything all at one time, but going back to the concept of who pays for the buildings and at what percentage, I guess it would seem to me that if you buy the argument that the state should be paying 100% for education, that it would seem to follow that there shouldn't be districts that have to pay 30% compared to others that need to pay 40% compared to others that need to pay zero. I mean, why wouldn't that follow also? Or maybe it does.
Representative Ledoux, through the chair. First of all, I am not an attorney, but I have read most of the court cases that have come through, and it is my understanding, and there might be a little help from behind me, I'm not sure, but there was some court cases on about bonding and about taking care of high schools and schools. You have the Casale case that came out that was settled. It didn't go through the whole point of it, and the state ended up building more schools. But for whatever reason, and it's probably because it's not a formula-based, where we've said this is basic needs to it. It goes through a different area. And so from my understanding, the 70, 30, 60, 40, which could be changed. It used to be 90, 10. In fact, it was 100% at one time. Again, when the state didn't have money, guess what they did? They pushed it off on the municipalities. I know you're all, you know, surprised. But court-wise, buildings have been taken that direction, and I don't think we won that one. But in a real world with a state that had a lot of money and could do that, absolutely. Or one that could afford that everybody, you know, would be a borough. But that isn't the world that we live in. And so right now, for me, it is, it's about this particular constitutional portion of it.
Thank you.
Do we have any other Representative Peggy Wilson?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm thinking that, okay, if this goes through, and if we had, if we would have to go ahead and 100% fund schools all the way, and the municipalities wouldn't at all, that would be wonderful because that would give them more money. Okay. However, what that would do to our state budget would be that, one, there may be legislators that would say, well, we gave them local control, but they were doing something. They were donating something, but now we're given all the money, so why don't we have more say of how they teach? No, that's one thing that I'm thinking of. Another thing is I'm thinking, okay, the state has got this, this is the basket of money, and we're responsibility our responsibility as legislators is to look overall what we're funding in the state, and so we might have to stop funding some other things, and which very well might happen. So if we have to stop funding other things, then that might mean that we're not funding some of the things that, and the municipalities will just have to pick it up in a different way. I'm just trying to think. There's always unintended consequences when we do things, and so I think we have to be very careful and think overall, what are the unintended consequences here? And we want to be smart in what we're doing and think ahead of what the possibilities, what could happen that we're not thinking about. And I'm concerned about some of those other things because we've got a few years here that we know that our revenues aren't going to be up there for a while. We know that right now. And so we have to plan for that. So we have to be responsible. And here we're looking at the we kind of look at the policy. But overall, there's another committee that's going to be looking at the money side of it. And they may do some things totally different than what we're thinking. So I just think we have to be wise in what we do.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson. Very good points. But first of all, I found it interesting as I talked to people about this bill that they thought because they were giving something over $90 million, they gave them more local control. It doesn't give you any more local control. Those who only have impact aid going in has the same amount of control as municipalities does. And again, this has nothing to do with how much money the state has. It has to do with their responsibility. Yeah. They set the rules, and then they reneged on the rules. And the municipalities are the ones who lost on that. Also, I want to remind the committee that the extra amount that is being given still can be given. Do you really? I don't believe that Fairbanks could say, oh, great, they're going to give the $26 million and we don't have to, and we're not going to give that other $22 million. I would be very shocked that that would ever happen because, again, our community would say, no, we want to fund our schools to this portion of it. Yes, do we benefit because, you know, we can't go, you know, with that extra amount and can go back to the taxpayers? Absolutely. But that means they can fund them more. But to use the argument, first of all, that, you know, we don't have the money, well, too bad. And we should, you know, the Constitution was written, a mandatory act. We made boroughs become boroughs, whether they wanted to or not, based on a promise we didn't keep. Will we have to take it out of somewhere else? Well, last I had heard, children are like our number one priority in the state, unless that's changed in the last few minutes. So if some others don't get it, well, sometimes you just have to take on those responsibilities and figure a better way to do it. But again, this is about the Constitution and what we're required to do, not our pocketbooks. And so I appreciate what you're saying. And before I put this bill forward, I looked at all those things, and it kept coming back that the state made a promise that they didn't keep. And now we're saying the same thing, because when we had money, why didn't we go back and change it if it was about the money? When we were rolling in all the money and we were dishing it out here and out there that we should have maybe been saving more of it, we didn't address that then. But now all of a sudden we don't have the money and, too bad. Well, that just really, when it comes to the Constitution, doesn't work. But I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Ledoux.
Is there anything that we can do about the cap? I mean, how do you get a... Is the cap a federal thing that, I mean, basically mandates that one district can't give too much money because you want everybody on an equal playing field?
Through Chair Representative Ledoux, that is my understanding, is that you, before they had the cap, certain areas were able to give more money than others could even afford to do, and so that was set by the federal government.
So why don't they mandate that parents can't help their kids with homework, you know, because some parents don't help their kids with homework. It just doesn't make any sense.
Person will do through the chair. Sounds like a policy call.
Thank you. Do we have any further questions for the representative? Representative Peggy Wilson.
I just have to say that it doesn't make any difference what promises. We change our laws all the time from one thing to another. Since I've been here, we've changed a lot of the rules and regulations that in education, actually. And so I'm just saying that I still stand on what I'm talked about unintended consequences, because we will have unintended consequences, and it doesn't make any difference we have to look at reality. So
one last thing, Representative Wilson, through the chair. Changing statute is something that we can do through policy.
Yeah.
That is absolutely different than this. To change the Constitution, I believe that there's a resolution about school choice, and if we could just go do whatever we wanted, we could have school choice without going through the resolution. Mm-hmm. But my understanding, and this is just my understanding, that the Constitution sits at a completely different standard than what we do for bills and laws. It has a process. So that's why I think this is at a different level, because this is about the Constitution. If we don't want this, if we don't want to take care of what we right now are mandated to do, then let's put it out to the voters and say, some of you should pay, some of you not so much. And I have a strange feeling that everybody would try to make this as equal to the original promise as they could. And sadly to say, we don't always hold to our promises, and that's wrong. And so I'm trying to correct one of those wrongs.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. And with that, is there anybody from the administration that would like to speak to this bill? Just checking. Okay. Any questions? Oh, Representative Ledoux.
Does AMM support this bill?
I'm back. Representative Wilson from District 2, Fairbanks. Representative Ledoux, through the chair, I don't know. I have not heard from them, so I would assume that they didn't support it. They're usually really good about telling us. But I don't know whether they've had meetings since this has been filed to be able to give that opinion at this point.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Seaton.
For the administration.
And if you'll please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you. For the record, Elizabeth Nittleman, Director of School Finance for the Department of Education.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The question was on the fiscal note on designated reserves and endowments. That $206 million each year, how is there money in that endowment? I mean, normally we've been funding that to the amount that we would do for the amount that we put into that endowment in the last several years has been equal to the amount that we paid in the last year. This is requiring an extra $200 million, so this is saying there's $200 million is going to come out of that endowment. Is there $200 million above the basic the funding that we have for education sitting in the endowment?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, this would shift costs from local to the state, and the state does not have $200 million at this time to address this portion of the bill.
Representative Seaton.
So then this allocation of public education fund, AS 1417-300, there's not money in there to do that. So that would I was confused at why the why it was set to the fund when there isn't money in the fund. I mean, isn't this going to be general funds? It's not going to, this should be a general fund, not an endowment fund, because there's no money in that endowment fund to pay for this.
And through the chair, Representative Seaton, you make a good point, and I would review our presentation for that and get back to you.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Reinbold.
Okay. Thank
Thank you very much. Basically, what I want to ask is the total contributions from K through 12 education. Do you know the total amount annually that we pay as a state, federal, and local control, just the total dollar amount for K through 12 education? And do you have the breakouts of the percentages?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, I don't have those numbers before me this morning. The department does have that information. And one place that you can view that information and the public can view that information is on the Department of Education's website. And we have a all revenues report and that categorizes the audits that each of the 53 school districts turn into the state on November 15th. And if information is needed beyond that, I'd be happy to provide it.
Follow up.
Representative?
With all due respect, you know, I've asked this question several times. There's a lot of Department of Education, you know, that typically comes in these meetings. And I think you guys should come prepared with those numbers so that at a public hearing that everyone can hear, including those listening gavel to gavel online. Thank you.
And again, Representative Gaddis, through the chair, Representative Reinbold, my information is that we were here for House Bill 245, and I'd be happy to go back to the office and provide any further information for you.
Thank you. Representative Ledoux.
So since it doesn't seem like there's a huge amount of money that if this bill passed to pay for it, what would be the plans if, well, maybe the bill doesn't pass, but maybe the court actually holds that this is what the state has to do. What's the contingency plans? What's plan B?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, that clearly is a discussion for the legislature. And again, we don't have, the department's attorney here. And I couldn't speak to this being not constitutional. That has not been determined. So I really don't have a outlook that far out.
Now, I realize it is a discussion for the legislature, but the administration, the governor's office, puts out a budget. So I was just wondering whether there might be some thoughts about it.
And through the chair, Representative Ledoux, this bill was filed after the governor's put out his budget, and we're here to provide information and discuss it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any more questions? With that, we'll go to public testimony, and thank you. We have on Mike Coons from Palmer. Mike, are you there?
Yes, ma'am, I am. Go Tanny.
And Mike, please introduce yourself and who you may be with.
Okay, my name is Mike Coons. I'm from Lazy Mountain in Palmer area. First of all, before I get my prepared, Representative Reinbold was absolutely right. As a citizen, I would sure like to see education coming forward to testify with numbers and, you know, to answer questions instead of I'll get back to you and we never hear about it. My prepared statement. I fully endorse Representative Tammy Wilson's HB 245. I have read the bill, and except for a couple non-substantive proposed changes in wording, I fully agree that changing from shall to may for cities, municipalities, and boroughs paying additional education funding is one of the tenets of conservative thought, less government and more local control. In point of fact, should this bill pass and be signed into law, I would suggest that the local communities, if they want to continue with funding, change who pays for education from the property taxes. I would suggest that those of us who do not have children in school, either because the children are grown up and out of the district, parents who use private or homeschooling, or like myself, no children, make education at the local level truly a user fee. There's additional funding, Representative Drummond. Then I would suggest this then leaves the boroughs the opportunity to help protect the public with having a sheriff form of law enforcement. The last numbers I heard was that 60% of my property taxes goes to education. I would have no problem with paying for a sheriff department. I would dare say the cost would not come to that previous 60%, which then gives me a decrease in property taxes and gives me better public safety on top of the state troopers. As do those who will scream and holler about their increased property taxes for their children. I respond with the following. In many cases at assembly meetings, I have heard the parents demand for full funding of education, and many times I've heard, quote, I'll pay more taxes to get my kids education, end quote. This is a good opportunity for those people to, as Vice President Joe Biden likes to say, quote, get some skin in the game, end quote. Now is a good time to put up. I would dare say that the additional offshoot to this would be more parental taxpayer involvement in their children's education. I am sure that NEA will have lots to say negatively about this, for this will potentially make school boards trim the budgets to be more student-friendly than NEA Alaska-friendly. This bill, along with HB 196, will undoubtedly reduce or take away NEA's powers over the school districts. Add to that Senator Dunleavy's proposed constitutional amendment, SJR 9, and we potentially have a perfect storm to really do something substantive towards better local control, less NEA union control, and more student-defined approach to education that will have students more ready for life versus being pegged, filling holes by Common Core's approach and the new standards pushing for. In closing, costs can be, and if all bills on education are passed this session, the cost of education should drop while performance standards are increased. And I thank you, and I'll answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Coons. And as the department indicated, they do have that information on their website. If you can't find it or have a problem, by all means, contact my office and we'll get it to you. But that's a lot of information that they have, so if you will, go to the website, and if you can't get what you need, let me know. With that in mind, we have Diane Hutchison. Are you still there, Diane?
Yes, I am.
And please introduce yourself for the record.
Okay, can you hear me all right?
Hear you loud and clear.
Okay, I'm Diane Hutchison, and I currently serve on the Fairbanks North Star Borough Assembly, and I was the past presiding officer for the past 2 years. I just wanted to fill you in on our assemblies, the timing and everything. The assembly has not yet taken a position on this bill, but I can tell you that there's a resolution that I co-sponsored. The borough mayor and the current presiding officer are also co-sponsors that will be bringing for a vote before the next assembly regular meeting, which is next Thursday, asking our assembly to join the Ketchikan Gateway Borough's lawsuit as the amicus curiae party. Following the vote on that resolution, depending on how that turns out, I plan on introducing a resolution in support of Representative Wilson's bill and bring it forth with the appropriate wording on how that previous resolution's vote turns out. So I can give you the reasons that I'm bringing this forward to the Assembly, and I think many of them were addressed. By the way, I was outside the LIO this morning at 8 a.m. and stood up there for a while and finally came back to work because nobody was there. I just want you to know that. So I'm calling from work. For fiscal year 2014, the Fairbanks North Star Borough budgeted local contribution to the schools was a little over $48 million. And out of that $48 million, almost $27 million is the required local contribution by the state. And the budgeted additional supplemental funding is over $21 million. I believe that the $27 million in required local contribution is, in fact, a state tax on the residents of my borough, and it's not imposed on all residents of the state. I had the Ketchikan Gateway Borough come in December and present to our assembly, and I asked how many people in the room, and it was a pretty full room, how many people in the room paid a state income tax? And I know you won't be surprised to find out that nobody raised their hand. But when I asked how many paid local property taxes, including the amount that's for this required local contribution to the school district from the state, everyone in the room raised their hands. My point is that every time the state mandates more basic need proportional funding from the municipalities that support their school districts, then those residents, not the rest of the residents of the state, but those residents pay a state-mandated tax. I myself personally believe this is unconstitutional. Like I said, we will be bringing this before the assembly at the next meeting. to see if they want to join the lawsuit, and also in support of Representative Wilson's bill. This is a disincentive for any unincorporated areas in the state right now to ever form a borough. Because what you've done is basically, as was brought out in your testimony, you've taken reductions in state funding, and even as you're talking about how the budget's going to be in problems, and you're willing to push that down on the municipalities who have their own funding problems in the form of, please pay for these additional state services that we will pay for in other areas, and raise your property taxes to do it. Last year, we our area passed two bond issues. One was to fund construction of a new school, and one was to fund other major renovations on the schools. These were items that we had come to Juneau and asked for funding for. The new school is to replace the junior high that's been seismically condemned, and we are piecemealing those structural reinforcements together just so we can keep students in that school until we can get a new one built. The funding was denied by the state legislature, as it often is. We come as a local government with our hands out to Juneau because we're taxing ourselves pretty much to the max, and when we could be paying for these projects ourselves without indebting future generations, if we would just have the state fulfill its obligation to fund basic needs and let us fulfill our obligation to the local taxpayers for the supplemental education funding, for investing in local capital projects, and reducing some of, or even reducing some of the tax burden on the people who are strapped by property taxes and high energy costs. Most of you know, I'm sure all of you know, that yesterday we heard that Flint Hills Resources is discontinuing its refining operations in North Pole. This is the borough's fourth largest taxpayer. Now, I'm in full support of SB 21. I think that for the future of our state, we need to get increased throughput in taps, and I think SB 21 will do that. But that does not relieve the state of its constitutional duty to fund basic education for everyone in the state. Yes, it will mean finding funds or less funds going to something else, but you know, a lot of those funds for capital things that go to municipalities, we could actually fund ourselves and know that we're funding them if we had, in our situation, that extra $27 million each year. So I thank you for listening, and I thank you for your service to our state. I hope you all give HB 245 serious consideration, because I believe it's the taxpayers in the state of Alaska, in all areas of the state, are going to start realizing how big of an issue this is. Because if you remember, the only taxpayers in the state of Alaska that are non-corporate are the people who are residents of municipalities. And I would venture to guess that most of you represent constituents that are in these areas. You also may represent constituents who don't pay property taxes, but I would be willing to venture that most of you represent constituents who pay property taxes, so they're the only ones in the state that is paying for these state services. You're forcing the local governments to become state tax collectors. So I thank you for your time and your energy on this, and thank you for listening.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Hutchison. And we do have a question for you, if you don't mind. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It seems in the testimony that the greatest disturbance is that REAs get their contribution through impact aid deduction instead of through property tax. And I totally agree with you that the state has requirements for generating revenue. So we have a tax, a property tax on oil and gas properties. We currently don't have a statewide property tax. However, we could institute a 3.5 or 4 mil statewide property tax on all assessed properties in the state to pay for education. So would it be more comfortable for you to have a statewide property tax as the mechanism for the state to generate revenue to pay for education? And would that satisfy that inequity problem that you're discussing?
Representative Seaton, yes, sir. In my mind, my whole complaint with this, I don't have a problem paying my property taxes and having the amount go to education is there. It goes back to what Representative Wilson said, though. in my mind, this is a constitutional issue. If you were to put a statewide property tax in there, you could have the legislature having control over that mandated tax. And that's what the Constitution calls for you to do, is for you to have control of a mandated tax that would be a statewide tax. And right now what you're doing is you're saying we're going to treat incorporated municipalities as reducing the state share. That's what this is. This is a reduction of the state share by you increasing the tax on your local taxpayers. And so, yes, in my mind, if you put in a statewide tax, if that's what you'd like to do to fund this, it would become a dedicated statewide tax, and it would fulfill the Constitution. Right now, I don't think that the tax on the local municipalities is what the Constitution envisions. And certainly the Mandatory Borough Act did not envision that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Would the bill sponsor like to speak to that question as well? I'm assuming so. Please put yourself on the record again.
Representative Tammy Wilson, District 2, Fairbanks, North Pole. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Seaton through the chair. I made sure that you all had at least the breakdown of basic needs, and I want to let you know on just for Fairbanks, and it's not all about Fairbanks. Well, yeah, it is. But anyway, local contribution for us is $26,940,000. That's required. We also give impact aid. We also have another $13 million. So this really isn't about impact aid, you know, local contribution, who gives, who doesn't. It's about the mandate. You know, it is about that. It is the state's responsibility. So I want to make sure that, one, it's not about everybody being a borough. It's not about, you know, some groups, you know, pay this much impact aid and some pay this. It's about what we're supposed to do. We're the ones that made the formula. The state made the formula. The state then, through the mandate on boroughs, said that we'll take care. This is one of those that we'll take care of, which are schools, which is education. It didn't come back to only when you can afford. I couldn't find that in the Constitution anywhere, that you will take care of your responsibility only if the revenue is at a certain level. And so I just want to make sure, you know, we don't kind of get off on these tangents about affordability, non-affordability. It comes back to that there's very few things in the Constitution that we are mandated to do. There's a lot of things that it encourages us to do. There's a lot of things we encourage our municipalities. But education was put in there that we will fund education adequately. We can fight over what adequate is, but at this point, we, the legislature, has determined it by a formula. What we've done, though, in that formula, we have then said we're going to let the municipalities, whether they want to or not, pay a portion of that. And so I just want to make sure that, you know, because I don't want this to be one part of the state against another part of the state, because that is not my intent. My intent is going back to the Constitution and funding education at an adequate level based on what is currently there. And so, you know, you can talk about impact aid. You can look down the list and see some pay, some don't, all different amounts. Do you do, as you said, some kind of state property tax? You could, if you wanted to. You could go back to everybody pays in so much on their first check. There's a lot of ways of doing that, but to make only one segment, and that's what we've done at this point, responsible, is what this bill addresses.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. And with that, we'll go to OffNet. David Neese, are you there?
Yeah, hi, this is David Neese.
And David, if I could, we've got a couple other things. We're fortunate to have a confirmation where we have somebody that's actually flown in. So if you can keep your comments real short, we'll be holding this over for another time so we can move on. So
yeah,
Mr. Neese, go ahead.
Thank you. It's just a short comment. I was actually in the Anchorage Library yesterday looking at the 1961 Anchorage Independent Borough School District budget, and at that time, Anchorage had a mill rate of 11.1, and the budget was split 47% state contribution, 47% local contribution. So this bill, in effect, shifts it all back to the state as a responsibility, and I think Representative Tammy Wilson is on the right track with this. I think that how you pay for it is basically the legislator's problem to solve. But by taking this out, and we've always done our funding for the state by reacting to what the courts have told us to do. This is the first time somebody has tried to get in front of the courts and say this is what we're supposed to be doing. So I think the committee probably should look at this. There's a lot of very good questions, but worrying about funding it needs to come after you decide, do you want to be mandated by the court to pay for it, or do you want to take care of it, because you probably should have.
Thank you, Mr. Neese. And we'll go to Posey Boggs. Are you with us?
Hi. Thank you very much. Yes, I am.
And please introduce yourself and who you may be with for the record, please.
Yes, ma'am. My name's Posey Boggs. I'm a longtime Alaskan with children raised in Anchorage. I also am volunteer for Literate Nation Alaska Coalition, the Alaska branch of the International Dyslexia Association, which are both nonprofits, and then a grassroots movement called Decoding Dyslexia Alaska. And so I am testifying on all of those entities or people. This is what I have to say. If the Alaska Constitution says fund education 100%, then fund it. Second, picture the landscape in Alaska. If the outcomes of those funds produced 90% literacy rate across the whole state, the cost of illiteracy or semi-literacy in Alaska is huge. I would like to refer to a document from the For Excellent Education that took a look at the economic impact of students who don't graduate and get a diploma. Literacy drives a huge piece of the dropout rate, although I am trying like a bloodhound to find the exact statistics that talk about that.
Ms. Boggs,
yes, ma'am.
We'll have public testimony again on this. We have some folks from out of town that, and I don't mean to cut you short, but if you can email my office, we'll certainly pass it around as well. I hope you don't mind.
No, I don't mind at all.
Appreciate it.
It's got some lovely numbers that if the landscape in Alaska produced literate graduates, I think we would be jumping for joy and you'd have a great outcome for your investment. Thank you very much.
Perfect. Thank you so much. And next we have Barbara Haney. Are you with us, Barbara?
Yes, I am.
And,
how are you?
And Barbara, I'm sure you've heard me say that we've got a few visitors from out of town, and we want to be sure we get them, plus another bill up. So, again, if you could keep your comment short, appreciate it.
Yeah, I'll keep it short. To support Representative Wilson's legislation, wholeheartedly, as many of you know, I am quite vocal and quite active in education matters, and I'm also a homeschool mom, one of which was dyslexic and just graduated the top of her class from a college in Illinois.
Yeah. I'm sorry, you're kind of garbled, and I needed to put you on the record in the beginning. So can you start out with who you are and who you may be with?
Yeah, my name is Barbara Haney. I'm an economist by trade, but I'm with myself, and I work for myself. And I strongly support the bill that Representative Wilson has put forward that places funding on the state of Alaska, as the Constitution indicates. For a long time, the state has worked around the but this is an increasing tendency for the Department of Education in particular, but not uniquely to the Department of Education, to create mandates and then try to put the cost on the local community. If we're going to have somebody who can mandate certain things, like the Common Core curriculum, without getting local support to those among the parents, then perhaps the state needs to start picking up the bill on that. There's a whole lot of mandates that we had a near miss on with a consortium if we had stayed in that, that would have been a huge cost on districts. So
Barbara,
I don't think you pick that up.
Thank you, Barbara. Barbara, do you have that written down? We had a tough time kind of understanding the connection. And if you do, if you can send it into my office, we'll get it out. With that, is there anybody in the audience that would like to speak to this bill? Okay, we'll hold this bill over, and we're kind of going to go off script a little bit. If we could have Ms. Enright come forward. And if you could introduce yourself for the record and to remind our folks here in their packet, she is the governor's appointment to the University of Alaska Board of Regents. Please go ahead and introduce yourself.
Courtney Enright, and I'm a student from the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
And thank you for coming down. A lot of times we do this over the phone, so it's really nice to see a face. And we're really not as tough as we look. I mean, usually these go pretty easy. So does anybody have any questions based on her resume? Let me back up. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, it may inspire questions.
Absolutely. I was born and raised in Ketchikan, Alaska. I'm currently attending the University of Alaska Fairbanks. I'm a mechanical engineering student, but I'm also working on my master's in business administration. I ran for this position with really two things I cared passionately about. I've had the privilege, perhaps you could call it that, of attending UAS, UAA, and UAF during my time, and I had experienced different issues with transfer, and that was something I really wanted to get into, was how we make our system more cohesive from a student perspective, because I have seen it personally, but also with my friends as they're transferring across the system, because we as students do that from time to time. And I guess the second one was I didn't really fully understand where we were going at the time with the Shaping Alaska's Future initiative. I've come to support it a lot more now that I've had the opportunity to get into the process, but I really wanted to see more where we were going with that and where we were going to see our vision for the future of Alaska.
Thank you. Do we have any questions? Representative Saddle.
Thank you, Ms. Enright. Thank you for putting yourself forward for this. I have to ask, seeking both a master's and an engineering degree at the same time, do you have time to take on the additional responsibilities that this post would entail?
Yes, I have made time. I've been serving in this class for the last 6 months, and it does take time. We do have agendas from 600 to 800 pages, but it's simply a matter of proper time management, I find.
Good luck to you.
Representative Reinbold.
Hello. Thank you very much again for coming forth, and I enjoyed hearing you last night in our education subcommittee as well. Just a couple things. First of all, congratulations on all your scholarships. You've got the longest list of scholarships I've ever seen, so that's pretty impressive. I know those are a lot of work to fill out. But I do want to ask two questions, the first question being, what improvements do you think need to be made at the University of Alaska right now, or university system in general?
I think that we are in this process, but I think we need to make the University of Alaska appeal to students within the state that they need to see higher education as one of the potential paths forward. And I don't know that we always do that effectively to students who aren't your conventional 4.0, excellent academics. And I think we also need to come across more as one university system. Most students don't seem to understand that we all work together and that you can pursue degrees in all 12 of our campuses and that there's different opportunities within that. And I think we do need to do a better job communicating that.
Okay, and as a follow-up, with budgets tightening, you know, we spend a lot of money on the university, as you well know. Only about 15% come from tuition, and I think the total budget's somewhere close to $1 billion. So with tightening the budgets, do you feel like you can have an impact and help us to meet the needs, however, be more efficient with the university? Do you think that you could play a role in helping that?
I think I can. I do believe that we are in a very effective process of doing that, and I do think that having been to all three universities, I've seen a little bit of how they all operate. They all operate a little bit differently, and I think from there I can bring forward some of that knowledge and help us come forth as we reduce duplications in our system and thus make ourselves more efficient.
Thank you.
Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Enright, thank you for coming to my office yesterday on the spur of the moment. We had a wide-ranging conversation, and I'm quite confident that you can fulfill your responsibilities as a member of the State Board of Regents. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. Representative Peggy Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know Courtney personally, and so she is quite a remarkable young lady, and there's not a doubt in my mind that she will be able to carry on and really help make a difference. And I'm very proud of her, what she's accomplished, and she's actually tries to get involved in the community also, so I think that's great.
Thank you. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Real briefly, I just wonder if your perspective on the university is that it should expand its offerings. There's been some conversation about adding a law school and a med school. Should it maintain itself the status quo, or would you consider that it's time to shed some programs? Just a general orientation.
I think we need to do a bit of both. I think we need to reduce our program offerings in some respects. I do believe, having gone through that, we have programs that are we have too many programs to maintain with excellence, and I'd like to see that us do that with excellence. I don't believe that we are ready to build a law or a medical school in the state, but I do believe firmly in creating pathways, and I would like us in the future, much as we have with the vet med, much as we have with the WAMI medical program, I would like us to see us pursue that with law so that we provide those opportunities for students, but I don't see us building that infrastructure, and I don't see that any time in the near future.
Representative Ledoux.
I just want to comment that I have a friend who serves on the Board of Regents, and Courtney has been serving on that for the past 6 months, and I checked her out with my friend, and my friend told me she was great.
Good job. Thank you. With that perfect segue, is there a motion to move this nominee forward?
Madam Chairman, I move to forward the nomination Courtney Enright for the University of Alaska Board of Regents to a joint session of the legislature for confirmation.
Seeing no, you have moved forward. Thank you. And thank you for coming to Juneau and speaking to us directly. I appreciate it. We'll take a brief at ease. Okay, we're back on the record. And the next bill we had for a hearing was House Bill 220, and we have the bill sponsor in front of us. If he'll introduce himself for the record, we'll begin.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the opportunity and the committee to bring this bill. My name is Representative Pete Higgins from District 5. Today we have HB 220, which is basically getting rid of the exit exam. So it's the repeal of the high school qualifying exam. This is a long time coming. It needs to be done. And, you know, I have a personal story in this. You know, as you say, you have a dog in the fight. Well, and this is the deal. I graduated. I don't want to say when, but it was a long time ago before the exit exam was there. And in that time period, we didn't realize about handicaps that people have. Some of you may know this. Some of you may not. But I guess I'm handicapped. I was deemed I have dyslexia, and I didn't know that, and I struggled through school, but I've accomplished a lot in life, all right, and the only reason I really kind of know that is because when I went to dental school, they figured that out real quick. In fact, it was the second day I was at dental school that they said, "Pete, why are you here and how did you get here? Because you're not supposed to be here." And so I had to go through all these testing, and they figured it out, and they figured out ways for me to pass the exams properly, which I didn't know that, okay? And if this exit exam was there for me to pass, there was no way I could have passed this exam by the way it was. Even though I'd passed all my grades and I've passed everything I'd done, I could not have passed this exam without the conditions that were put upon me, you know, at Creighton. And I'm grateful for that because I learned a lot on how to do it and how to get through exams and what my brain needs to do it. You know, it's not saying that we're dumb or anything like that. It just says that under pressure, we just don't think right. Our brain short circuits out to a degree. So I have a real, that's what I said, that's my dog in the fight because I really feel for the kids that go through K through 12, pass everything that the Alaska statute requires of them to get a diploma from high school, but for whatever reason cannot pass this exam, and they get a diploma of just of accomplishment. I think that's a travesty to our students. I think it's a travesty to everyone that has to go through this. This exam was brought about by No Child Left Behind. It was attached to some federal aid that is no longer needed any longer. This exam is basically, we don't need it any longer, and it's time for us to move on. This exam costs us $2.7 million to do, and Representative Reinbold, you were talking about budgets and how we have to constrain and get a little tighter. Well, this is an opportunity to save $2.7 million, and we can use that money and better serve it in other areas of our educational system. So that, in a nutshell, is what this exam, what this is about. My staff, Julie Morris here, is going to try to carry the bill for me. I'm actually in another committee right now, and we're talking about other energy issues. But if you have any questions for me, I'm here right now, so you can ask.
Representative Ledoux.
After you graduated from Creighton, you're a dentist, correct?
I am.
Did you have to take dental boards?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
How'd you pass those?
Well, believe it or not, the dental boards are set up to actually comply with disabilities. And so you can, you have to write them and let them know what it is. And you have to be documented that you have it. And then once you're able to do that, and it's basically a time constraint. They take away all time constraints. Once you get rid of the time constraint and a few other little things, like, for instance, spelling is not an issue anymore for that. And then the other issue is I can't be in a room with other people because for some odd reason people with my handicap, we seem to look at other people, and then we start to get kind of, the brain starts to short circuit out. But if you're by yourself and you don't have any time constraints, believe it or not, my grades went from C to D's to B's and A's. It was just unbelievable. That little change alone was amazing to me, the difference. But I didn't know that. And, of course, all the experts did. So,
Representative Ledoux.
So is the real problem the exit exam itself, or should there simply be accommodations made for people who are in your situation? I mean, tests are a part of life.
Well, they are part of life, but the exit exam has nothing to do with what we need to do. What is the exit exam? What was its purpose to begin with? What was it? It was to determine how our children are graduating out of high school and at what level. And so that we can adjust to that and make our curriculum better or whatever we have to do, right? I mean, that's what's its purpose? And it serves no purpose because if you look at the history behind it and what we've done, it hasn't accomplished what it was set out to do. So it's the exit exam. And we have other exams that we can take that the governor's mentioned, the SATs and whatnot, that will serve much better purpose than this exit exam. So in my opinion, it serves no purpose.
And if I might interject, I was around when the exit exam was talked about, and I think that the general thoughts with the public were that we wanted to see that our kids could get out of high school and have some basic skills. And I think that businesses wanted to know that our kids were prepared, and that was the original goal. And I sit on a task force with Dr. Jerry Covey, who was a commissioner at the time, and I do tease him about being the father of the exit exam, and I don't know if you'll have him online, but he certainly has indicated that the original premise, it certainly hasn't fulfilled itself
right
in that regards. So with that, Representative Sadler.
Oh, thank you very briefly, Mr. Chair. I would also, having had some small role in the passage of that as a staffer, it was not conceived originally as an assessment tool of where a student stands in a continuum. It was rather a raw guarantee of some minimum level of competency in high school graduates. Again, I believe it was instigated and requested by members of the business community who wanted to make sure that a high school diploma meant a certain level of competency, not measuring how far above or how far below, just a cut score.
Any other questions for Representative Higgins? As his staff will be here to follow up on the rest of the presentation, I know that he's got a committee to go to. So, Representative Ledoux.
I just want to clarify, Representative Higgins, I thought you said that the exit exam came about because of the No Child Left Behind Act, but I've also read, I think in a document that is in our packet, that it came before the No Child Left Behind exam. So I'm just trying to clarify that.
Well, from my understanding, it was brought about by the No Child Left Behind Act of 2001. That's what was the instigator of the exit exam, was that, to my all the documentation that I have. Now, there might have been some talk prior to that as far as trying to do something, but it wasn't until that was instigated that it actually happened. But we do have the department behind us, and they could probably clarify that for you a little bit more.
That's right. And as we go through this process, we'll bring them forward. Are there any other questions for Representative Higgins? Representative Ledoux? I'm sorry.
That's okay.
not that I've been used to calling on you, but please. Representative Reinbold.
Okay. Thank you. And basically what I wanted to just point out is the State Board of Education has supported you, it looks like unanimously, to the repeal of this. I think that's important to note. Also, when I look at the fiscal note, it just shows the $2.75 million, which is significant. But I guess I think it's much bigger than that. And my House Bill 140 looks at the impacts not only to one department, but all departments and all municipalities and even the private sector. That's what I think is a more valid fiscal note. But I can tell you that teachers in my district are supporting this that have contacted me. There's no one that says, let's keep this. But they said it's also freeing up their time. They said that some of their special needs students, it could take up to a week to get them through this exam. So it's much bigger than just this $2.7 million. It's having significant impacts in the classroom, freeing up teachers' time. So I definitely think this is a worthy discussion, and thank you for bringing it forth.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And you're entirely correct. You know, the domino effect of this is humongous. I mean, it's huge, where it'll free up a lot of more time for our teachers to do what they need to do. Mm-hmm. So I agree.
Any more questions for Representative Higgins? Representative Peggy Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that you're bringing this bill forward. I've actually was there in 2001 and voted for it, and I've regretted it ever since. So, and I also am dyslexic, and so I know how that feels and the challenges that it brings. So. Thank you for bringing it forward. I think there's some other ramifications that are also involved with it, and I spoke on the last bill about ramifications that we don't always perceive ahead of time. And one of those is that there are students that are very, very they need their lives. They need somebody to say when to get up and when to go to bed and when to eat and what to do, and they can do it if somebody just kind of, if they just kind of have a structure to what they do. And those are great people to be in the military, but they don't take those tests so well, and what's happened is these tests have prevented them from being in the military just because they haven't been able to pass the exit exam. So I'm really excited about this and very pleased that you're got the bill forward.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Representative Seaton.
And Madam Chair, I'd just like to say that, you know, I'm fully supportive of this bill. And the ramifications aren't, I would hate to see this labeled as for special needs students, because that's not the reason for,
right,
only reason for getting rid of this. We've had case after case after case where students come in, the majority of students pass at least parts of this in their sophomore year before they've ever taken the classes. So mm-hmm. It's been downgraded so far, but after they pass their quote exit exam, many kids sit back and relax instead of saying, well, geez, I've already passed my exit exam from high school. And it's a misnomer that they have high school competencies at that point in time. And so I'm very happy you brought this forward, because it has not only effects on special needs kids, but it has effects on the attitudes of kids of what they should learn in high school and how hard they need to work. And so I'm pleased to support the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Thank you, Representative Higgins. I guess you can go on to your next committee. And
oh, thank you. I appreciate it.
We'll grill your staff.
There we go. Thank you.
And please, staff, introduce yourself. Put yourself on the record, if you will.
Hello, I'm Julie Morris, and I work for Representative Higgins. And today you have a very nice piece of legislation. It's clean. It's neat. It doesn't have a lot of stuff in it. And I think I'm just really thrilled that we are at a point where we can actually produce something that has a negative fiscal note. I do want to take you to that fiscal note that was prepared by the department. It's $2.7 million a year. That kind of money that we could produce in savings and put back into education somewhere else that could be of better use. And as Representative Reinbold did state, we do have a resolution from the State Board of Education that supports this unanimously. So I just really encourage you to pass this bill out, and let's get moving on with reforming our education for the betterment of our kids. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for staff? With that, we'll ask the administration to come forward and speak to this bill. Please introduce yourself for the record.
For the record, my name is Les Morse. I'm the Deputy Commissioner at the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development. I would, on behalf of the board, speak that conceptually the removal of the high school exam is something the board supports. The administration is also supportive of this. There is another bill, though, that has a couple of different features. I think you'll be hearing that Friday, and we would ask you to, you know, look at those different features. And one is some transitional language, and the other is a different assessment that would require participation be required, but I'll leave that for Friday, and then beyond that, I'm really here for any specific questions around this bill.
Sure, thank you. Representative Peggy Wilson.
Section 6 of the bill provides for effective date of July 1st, and why can't we have an immediate date so that students in this school year wouldn't have to take it or pass it in order to graduate?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, my only concern around an effective date might have to do with the timing of it actually going into effect. So if the legislature were to pass this toward the end of the session and then the governor signs it within the allotted time that the governor has to sign it, we could get students caught in different places. And because graduations occur all the way from the beginning of May to the end of May, and the effective date, if it's effective the moment the governor signs it, you may have some students who have to pass it because they graduated before it was signed and others who don't have to pass it. It also could send some mixed signals this spring. If this doesn't pass, you don't want to send a mixed signal out and have students not taking the April administration of the assessment. So from my perspective, and it's certainly something you can deliberate on, but I think there could be some problems in terms of some students being required to pass this within the spring, some not being required based on the actual effective date of when it's signed, if it's passed and signed. And then just the message you send, because if it doesn't pass, you don't want to be sending messages to students they may not have to pass this exam when their last opportunity as a senior would be in April to take the test.
I'm going to ask a question real quick that follows up on this. So let me see if I understand this. So if it went into effect July 2014, and if there was a student that passed all of their requirements but did not pass the exit exam, let's just say didn't even take the exit exam, if they stall and wait for the bill to be signed, they now have a diploma. Could that happen, or is that what would happen?
me see.
You understand the question?
I think so, okay. Chair Gaddis, but maybe you may have.
Okay, let me try it again. So I'm a high school student, and either I can't pass the exit exam or I don't want to even take it. So I'm passing everything else. I've gotten all the credits that I need. If I just stall and stand by, school ends in May or June, and I wait until the governor signs this, if in fact it passes through, then do I have a high school diploma by the mere fact that I didn't have to pass it? Or does it count for when the governor signed it and only from thereafter?
Chair Gaddis, my understanding, and again, you may want to get mm-hmm. lawyers involved mm-hmm. in this, but yeah. my understanding is it takes effect from the moment it is signed forward.
I got it.
Therefore, if I graduated and my district provided me my certificate of achievement or diploma the week prior to its signing, that's the rules that affect me until it takes effect. And then my only opportunity to get that diploma is to find a way to go back and take the exam, which is some transitional language that we've suggested in the other bill.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To a different point, sir, looking at Alaska Statute 1403075, paragraph C, says that a student with a disability who cannot pass the exit exam either with or without an accommodation, as the sponsor described accommodations, can get a diploma through an alternative assessment program as required under that student's IEP. My question to you is, does the department keep records as to how often that alternative assessment method is implemented and results in a diploma?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, yes, we actually, let me just point out a couple of things. First off, a student, the first time they take the exam, can have accommodations. For example, if parts of the exam needed to be read aloud to them, that's an acceptable accommodation. That happens the first time they take it and any time they take it. That alternative assessment program are basically things that go beyond what we would call an accommodation. We actually allow for modifications of the exam. Spell check being used, I believe, would be considered a modification. So it is in that alternative assessment program. And yes, we track those because to get to use those modifications, an IEP team has to meet and convene, then they request the approval of having that exam modified from the state. And really, we aren't approving it. The IEP team primarily approves it. We just make sure everything is in order legally for them to get that. So we do track that. I don't have that data right in front of me, but I could get that data for you.
I would appreciate that.
Okay.
Thank you. Representative Ledoux.
Well, I'm going to start out by saying that I don't necessarily support the concept of eliminating an exit exam. But assuming that we're going to do that, and assuming that the testimony about all of these hardships that have happened because of the exit exam, why don't we have a retroactive effective date so that we just give everybody a diploma? I'm serious. That we just give everybody a diploma regardless of whether or not they've passed it for the past 10, 11, 12 years or so. Is that something we could do?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I think I don't know that you can do that or not. That seems beyond, it may be more of a legal question about how that would look. And it might be a question, a policy discussion that you want to have, because the exam may have very well fulfilled a very important purpose, and that you may or may not want to do that. So I think it's both a policy question for the legislature to have a discussion over, certainly, but there may be some legal issues you might want to look at there as well that I would be uncomfortable speaking to.
And for the folks listening and ourselves, we're going to hold this bill and talk about the governor's bill, if you will. HB 278 has a portion in there on the exit exam, because we want to do the right thing, and maybe a combination, who knows as it progresses. So, you know, it's some good information. With that in mind, we have Representative Reinbold.
Okay, and through the chair, basically, I'm just going to push hard on asking, is there any reason to keep this exam? I'm trying to look for any unintended consequences. Is this going to demotivate students and cause them not to, you know, achieve a certain goal? Is that paper, that exit exam, worth something to them right now? Is the business community, do they look at that and evaluate, you know, whether this is a good candidate to hire or not? And basically, I think, like the APS, Alaska Performance Scholarship encourages them to work harder and take harder courses. So I'm just looking for any unintended consequences. I can certainly see the benefit of freeing more time up for the teachers, but is there a value that this test provides in the community maybe that we might be missing?
Well, through the chair, Representative Reinbold, the assessment assesses basic competency skills. It really, I think, has had a value for students and for districts in terms of really ramping up the curriculum over the years that it's been in effect to make sure that we're addressing the needs of every student, and particularly those students who might have been exiting our system without basic skills. So I think it fulfilled a purpose. I don't know that it is necessarily a purpose that needs to still continue to be in place. Matter of fact, I don't feel that way, and that would be our position. But we do still think there's a need for information, but we need to be really preparing. Instead of making sure kids are just have their basic skills, do they have the set of skills necessary to take the next step, whatever that would be, when they leave high school? So.
And through the chair, so with the replacement test that we're going to be talking about on Friday, that would meet that need, do you believe?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, yes, and you'll hear more about that piece on Friday, but the administration is very supportive of that concept, yes.
Thank you, and with that in mind, let's keep in mind, I have about three people that would like to testify before we close up in about 10 minutes. So we will, of course, be taking this same conversation up on Friday. And Representative Peggy Wilson, did you have a quick comment?
I'll wait.
Okay. And Representative Drummond?
I'll also wait, okay, since we're going to continue.
You bet. Representative Seaton?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just like to have the administration come back, because I'm looking at either the grade 10 or grade 11 proficiency standards on these tests, and it seems like from 2009 through 2013, there's actually proficiency in both 10 and 11 have gone down. So I want an explanation for if this test is doing something for us and we're seeing decreased rates of proficiency, percentage of proficiency, almost every year, what's going on, and how is this test not been used to turn that around? So thank you, Madam.
That's a great question, and I'm sure we'll hear from you on Friday, mm-hmm, with that answer. Representative Sadler? Okay, looks like we have some questions for you on Friday. With that in mind, we'll take some public testimony. We have Mike Coons. Are you with us?
Yes, this is Mike Coons.
Okay, Mike, go ahead and introduce yourself for the record. I know that you have on a previous bill, but we need to have you do it again.
I understand that. My name is Mike Coons. I'm from Mazie Mountain and Palmer. I'm speaking for myself, and I'm not an NEA member. I support HB 220 as written. However, in the other body, and this kind of goes to what you guys were just talking about, in the other body, the companion bill, SB 111, has changed with a transition language added, and I quote, transition student testing in progress until June 30th, 2017, the school district shall continue to administer the competency exam under former AS 1403-075, and regulations adopted under former AS 1403-705 in effect until on August 31st, 2014, to a student who seeks to qualify for secondary school diploma under former AS 1403-75 as it was written on August 31st, 2014. And in Section 7, this act takes effect September 1st, 2014. My problem with this, and something I know you guys are all struggling with on this transition, is that this severely impacts young adults who are moving forward now as adults. Yes, I realize this will be the last class to take the exit exam. It is a logistical matter more than anything else. I'm sure there will be those students who will look at this as an opportunity to see how well they will do for upcoming SATs that they plan to take.
There are others, like I was at 18, who will take it because we must, and what the heck, see how well we do and not be worried about it. Then there will be those who weren't going to pass the test anyway, and within that are those who have not passed the required classes and may not get a diploma under any circumstances. So let this exit exam die a quiet death with minimal impact on the students. For it to do the transition, this then impacts those trying to go into the military, since most require a diploma for enlistment, and those students who will look at this as just another hoop to jump through. Myself, if I were going into the military, I'd take the test. If I didn't pass the math, I'd get my transcripts for the entire high school years and submit that to any future employer instead of a sheepskin diploma. I strongly believe that when I see a problem, to not only identify it, but to come up with an alternative or a fix to that problem. Thus, delete the transition student testing in progress and instead insert procedures for graduation, section 140375, college and career assessments. A, a student shall be issued a secondary school diploma upon completing all required course study through high school with a 2.0 GPA or higher. B, a student who fails to qualify for issuance of a diploma under A of this section will be held back so the student can take the needed courses to meet the 2.0 GPA requirement upon successful completion of the diploma will be issued. As to SB 111, line 30, change September 1st, 2014 back to July 1st, 2014. And I also have emailed this to you, so you'll have my proposed changes to this.
Thank you, Mike. And, of course, for those online, we will be taking this exit exam conversations and bill up on Friday. But let's move up to the next one. Sally from Hoona, and I'm sorry, Sally, I can't pronounce your last name, but I'll let you give it a try.
You bet. Thank you so much. My name is Sally Bizzall, and I'm the president of the Hoona City Schools Board of Education. Most things that I wanted to say have already been said by our representatives and the administration. I believe a new assessment system with the content standards will be much more accurate indication of what students have learned in their 13 years of school. Our number one goal is that 100% of our students will graduate from high school in 4 years. We want to support repealing this exit exam because we feel it has pushed out and prevented some of our students from getting the diploma, which and what it represents for their futures. Thank you.
Thank you, Sally. Next, we'll go to Anchorage to Mary Nanwalk. Mary, are you there?
Yes.
And Mary, please introduce yourself and who you may be with for the record.
My name is Mary Nanwalk. I'm calling from Anchorage. However, I'm reading from the bush, and education is one tool for the bush areas who really have a lot to teach you. And I'm glad that no one has been, for lack of their answer, no one has been using the excuse that they're not a rocket scientist. However, now people are saying, I'm not a teacher, I'm not a counselor. And then everybody's excuse for their, in quotes, credibility is, my wife is a teacher, my wife is a social worker. And then education, I think, is an answer to the same old problems that we see year after year after year after year after year. And I want to thank the Education Committee, and you ladies are wonderful. You have been raising the questions that we've all been raising ever since we were 9 months old, and believe you me. And then there's not only the state educational rules and laws, they are federal and like it or not, worldwide. And I just never liked it, and a lot of other people never liked it when there's inequality in. And I will tell you, the state of Alaska pretends to be poor. It's not poor. Alaska happens to be one of the richest states. There's a lot of mineral, I'm upset right now, and when I'm upset, my bad English turns from bad to worse.
Thank you, Mary.
Then I've heard that, but Mary? What I want to do is, I want everyone, from the janitor to the top person, to please consider everybody and be equal to everybody. And rather than like having Anchorage or Fairbanks, get all the money, give the money to the villagers whom you are constantly criticizing for not doing their job. I will tell you, the rural teachers and the villagers, from the babies to the eldest ladies, they do their job. And I'm not ashamed to say that, and they do a better job than the senators and the legislatures and the school boards, etc. So, and then I've been a product of a world education system, public, private, and all the in-between.
Thank you so much, Mary. Mary, we've got a couple others that we've got to get to in the next couple of minutes. And we ladies on the Education Committee really do appreciate your compliments, and we'll work on the guys. No, seriously, thank you so much for being involved.
Please keep at it. And when somebody gives you back,
thank you so much.
The little old man is pushing for us.
You bet. Thanks. You're welcome.
Thank you.
You bet. And next we'll go to Fairbanks. Ernie, are you with us?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. And if you'll introduce yourself, who you may be with for the record. And we've just got a couple of minutes. We've got at least one in the audience as well, so we'll try to rush you along.
I will make it brief. My name is Ernie Manzi, and I'm speaking as a parent and an individual. Although I had the privilege in the past of serving on the Governor's Council for Special Education and Developmental Disabilities, I'm not speaking for the council, but as an individual. Just a couple points I'd like to say. I certainly support the repeal of the high school qualifying exam, and I hope you don't confuse the repeal of the bill with an effort for lack of accountability or just a way around accountability. I very much support the idea of looking at SAT, ACT, and especially the work keys as an assessment. I think that is a valuable assessment for many students who are looking to enter the trades, looking to enter technical schools, and looking at programs other than the traditional two or four year college program. And I just want to just share from a parent's perspective. My son was on an IEP all through elementary, middle school, and most of high school. He passed the graduation qualifying exam on the last chance for his writing. And let me tell you what a worrisome time that was for his mother and I. You know, we didn't need that qualifying exam to know that he was weak in the area of writing. He knew it, we knew it, his teachers knew it. He passed it because we concentrated on it and through the support, especially of the staff at West Valley High School here in Fairbanks, was able to pass it. But the idea that somehow if he didn't pass it, that he was going to be denied a diploma when he had successfully met the course requirements just did not seem fair and appropriate at that point. And there are many, many students who are on IEPs that have struggled with that don't get a diploma. And you know, the results of that and what happens to them in terms of their options for future employment or continuing education is pretty significant. So, again, I support the repeal of this particular exam and also support the idea of looking at other assessments, be they ACT, SAT, work keys, and teacher assessments. I think we need to trust our educators. So, thank you.
Thank you so much. And if we can bring Valene Spencer, if she's in the audience. She's left the building. And since we only have a couple minutes, Representative Sadler, just a minute. Please go ahead. I'm sorry.
Thank you, sir. In regards to your previous statement, your son actually did finally pass the exit exam and communications. Was there value to his education to have that extra hurdle to pass to get the diploma? Or was that a valueless exercise?
I don't think the fact that he finally passed that really made the difference. What made the difference was we knew by talking to his teachers, by looking at his IEP, that he had a problem in that area, and we worked hard to address that through his IEP. And I think that's what really got him through, and what the most important thing was. And I think that's the purpose of the IEP. It coordinates parents taking an active role with their child, with the individual school and teachers in terms of providing the instruction that's necessary.
So again, just to put a fine point on it, so there was absolutely no value in having that final checkoff on the exit exam?
Well, there certainly was a value in the sense that if he didn't get the checkoff, he wasn't going to get a diploma.
Education value.
No, I think we knew through many other sources, through him taking the PSAT, through taking the work keys, where his strengths were and where his weaknesses were, and by working with his teachers, crafting the IEP to really hammer in and address those things. That's what made a difference.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. So we'll meet at our usual time here, Friday, February 7th, in this room. We're scheduled to hear HB 278, and we're going to break it out in chunks. And this particular chunk that we're breaking out will be the high school graduating HSGQE component of the bill. We'll also continue with HB 245 that we heard today, and we will take final public testimony on HJR 1. So with that, the House Education Committee is now adjourned.